Case number 14-1222 et al. HTH Corporation et al. Petitioners versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Rand for the petitioners, Ms. Sheehy for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Richard Rand and I represent the petitioners in this case, which is a rather unique case. We're here today because three members of the National Labor Relations Board, not at the request of any party and without notice to us and without giving us an opportunity to be heard, imposed extraordinary remedies, some of which are unprecedented.
You could have filed a motion, is that not correct?
We could have filed a motion for reconsideration. That would have been the only thing we could have done.
So that was an opportunity to be heard.
Well, we don't believe it is.
All right, and why not?
First, the board's own regulation on reconsideration limits it to extraordinary circumstances.
Well, you're arguing this is pretty extraordinary.
I would agree our argument is very extraordinary. And I would add so was the NLRB's in this case for that matter.
No. But your point was you had no opportunity to be heard by the board.
We had no opportunity to be heard before they imposed these extraordinary remedies.
Right.
And in fact, you did.
That's all I'm getting at.
Right.
You acknowledged that you could have filed a motion.
There was nothing to prevent us from filing a motion for reconsideration other than our conclusion that it would have been futile.
And futile because?
Because all five members of the NLRB had weighed in on this subject. This is rather unique. I have never seen another case where all five members.
I hadn't either. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That the five-member board came together. Now, two dissented in part. But I want to be clear, you argue this quasi-due process argument. You never had an opportunity to be heard. To the extent you're suggesting that's a due process violation, why would it have been futile to raise that since the board had not previously addressed that?
Again, because all as we talked about, all five members had staked out their position.
So their minds are closed.
Their minds are closed. And I think the suggestion that on a motion for reconsideration, which is for extraordinary circumstances, that they would have changed their mind based upon their precedent, because the three members relied upon the Camelot case, which came sort of in between our case. And they went through a very long dissertation trying to get around unbelievable. And the two dissenters said, you can't do that. This is really unbelievable, the case, and it's unbelievable in the result. So we thought it would have been futile. And we also believe that raising a due process argument to the agency, that's not where it should be raised, because agencies really aren't tasked with protecting due process.
Well, the board has an obligation to give people an opportunity to be heard. So it has that obligation. I just want to be clear about this. I'm not clear why you wouldn't have, just as a matter of protection, have filed a motion for reconsideration, since you could have predicted the board was going to raise that as an objection to our jurisdiction to even consider the merits of your argument.
Well, you know, we weren't sure the board would, and I'll tell you the reasons why. Would have raised this objection. I think they're doing it obviously because they don't want the merits to be considered. But I'll give you two.
Most agencies routinely raise an objection to our jurisdiction if they think there's a basis for it. And the court itself might sua sponte have to raise the question of its jurisdiction.
Yes. And our responses are twofold. First, the extraordinary remedies that were imposed, which were the reading by Mr. Minicola and the broad cease and desist order, we did accept to those. And in our brief in support of exceptions, we raised a very broad argument that we objected to any extraordinary remedies. And that's in the joint supplemental appendix. We said this is not a case that warrants extraordinary remedies.
And the board disagreed with you, so you had to tell them why in fact, and you could have told them.
We did tell them in our brief in support of our exceptions, Your Honor.
What did you tell them?
We told them that this is not a case, based on the facts, that warrants extraordinary remedies.
But the board had already gone through the facts, saying why it thought they did. So why didn't you have to tell them more than that you disagreed with the board?
Well, this was our brief in support of exceptions to the administrative law judge's extraordinary remedies.
Right.
So then when the board comes out with even greater extraordinary remedies, our conclusion was they didn't listen to us the first time. They're not going to listen to us the second time.
Okay.
And let me also point out, and this is not in the briefs, but it's in the record, in the first case, HTH1, which went to the Ninth Circuit, the administrative law judge recommended the payment of bargaining expenses. We accepted to them, and that went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit, and we argued it there. The board's argument is that we are a scofflaw, I guess, for lack of a better term, that we're recidivist.
And you lost in the Ninth Circuit.
We did lose in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah.
Yes. But the board's argument is that we don't obey their orders. So there's no question that they would have known we would have objected to any extraordinary remedy.
But my point is that the board's position was your client not only didn't obey board orders, ALJ orders, agreements it had entered into, the district court's injunctions. Don't you have to come forth and say something more than we disagree?
Well, I think under the circumstances of this case, no. Again, we argued that, and I've tried to harmonize all of the 10E cases, and it's difficult because they are not consistent. And I think the courts take a somewhat pragmatic approach to 10E. And the ultimate question is the board on notice that you're going to disagree with the remedy? And there's no question that the board was on notice here that we disagreed with any extraordinary remedies. What is also interesting is if you look at the unbelievable case, and if you look at the procedural history there, that was not a case where the administrative law judge ordered the remedy. What happened was after the record was closed, there were motions by the charging parties to assess the fees, and those were granted by the board. But I don't see, and I couldn't find, because the case is so old, the procedural history, I don't find where in that case they were required to file a motion for reconsideration. I think the fact that they had objected in that case, they had the opportunity to do so, was enough. But I think there's also a more fundamental problem going on here. The board comes before this court and says, we have the inherent authority to award attorney's fees, not only to the charging parties, but to ourselves. And we have the inherent authority to award litigation expenses. And we have that authority because we're essentially an Article III court, and this is the bad faith exception. The problem
they don't
with
quite
the,
say they're
an No, they don't
court,
quite say that.
I'm sorry?
They don't quite say they're an Article III.
Well, they
claim to have
quasi
disrespect yeah. powers of an Article III.
Right. But if a federal district court, sua sponte, sanctioned either a litigant or an attorney and did so and said, I'm just doing this, and here's my judgment, here's my order, and said that your only remedy is to file a motion for reconsideration under Rule 60 or appeal, I think we believe this court and every other circuit court would have grave difficulty with that procedure. Because the Supreme Court, I think in the Chambers case, talking about the inherent authority, said it's limited, and we have to limit it because otherwise courts could abuse it. And in so doing, they said there are due process concerns. You have to have notice and an opportunity to be heard. This is the only case I know of where the NLRB, not only sua sponte, but without the request of any party, there were no exceptions filed by counsel for the general counsel or the intervener to the ALJ's remedies, went off on its own and issued these remedies. And I think that is a very dangerous position for an agency to take, that we can do this sua sponte, you don't get notice and you don't get an opportunity to be heard, because the compliance proceeding, you don't get that opportunity. Compliance, they issue a specification and the burden is on you to show it's wrong. That does not comply with due process. And we think, regardless of anything else, that is a fundamental flaw in what the NLRB did here, because we had no notice. We had been through a prior proceeding, and in that proceeding we had notice that they were going to seek litigation expenses. we accepted to that and we litigated that, and yes, we lost. So we're in the second case, and no one's asking for these expenses. No exceptions are filed. We do accept to the extraordinary remedies, and then the NLRB turns around and, on its own, 3 years later, issues these remedies.
Well, what I don't quite understand about this case is the first go-around, you knew the board was going to impose what you have described to be an extraordinary remedy. You appealed that. Then the case went on, and it just got worse. And as a reasonable attorney, I'm going to suggest that you probably advise your clients that this was going to be a difficult row to hoe, given a decade and all the incidents that the board had elaborated. So I appreciate the arguments you're making about these are extraordinary, but at least in your case, your client knew that the board thought this was a very serious case, and your client's conduct was so serious that an extraordinary bargaining expenses remedy was appropriate. And the Ninth Circuit said that was a reasonable interpretation by the board of its authority, and you have not accepted here to the factual findings by the board. So isn't that the end of that case, to the extent it's properly before us?
Well, this is not an excuse, but I actually was not the attorney.
I'm sorry. Then eliminate everything I said.
No, I came in after, ironically, after the first case, after it was all said and done.
I didn't mean to cast aspersions or praise, all right? Let's just take that off the table. But my only point is that your client is a knowledgeable participant in interstate commerce. It's been before the board. It would not surprise me at all to think that they would have had an inkling that the board might impose some serious remedies, as they had the first time.
You're right. The first time they did, but again, we got notice of that. They did that in a typical general counsel for the general counsel, sought that as a remedy. It was before the administrative law judge. We had a chance to be heard, and we had a chance to file exceptions. I do not believe, and again, I'm sorry, I wasn't counsel in HTH1, that they sua sponte enhanced and ordered new remedies. So it's nice to be prescient, but I don't think we could have predicted what happened in this case. I don't think anyone could have predicted what happened in this case.
What about the fact that the board mentioned in its order the fact that it has done this type of thing in other cases? They haven't necessarily resulted in, you know, judicial decisions, but it has imposed these types of remedies before.
Well, they have. I mean, the bargaining expenses remedy is not something that's brand new. Awarding themselves litigation costs and to a charging party, as far as I know, the only other case I've seen where they awarded themselves litigation costs was the unbelievable decision by this court, where the court said no. And one very significant point about unbelievable is in unbelievable, this court said that if you're looking at the party's history, then it's a punitive remedy because you're punishing them for their past conduct. The NLRB's brief to this court spends 10 pages talking about our history. And for them to stand in front of you and say, this is not punitive, this is compensatory.
But the board's order, which is what we're looking at, addresses that.
Well, the board tries to get very cute and says this is compensatory.
Well, cute. I mean, that's your view.
Yes.
It seems to me five members of the board thought this was a serious enough matter for their time and attention. You were unanimous on everything except attorney's fees, and then Member Johnson talked about one other matter, and then there was this front pay issue, but that's really not before us.
No, the front pay was them sort of teeing up for that, and I'm glad I don't have that issue before me. But yes, it was a serious matter, but my point, Your Honor, is that the bad faith exception is punitive. The Supreme Court said that in NASCO, and I think there's a footnote in that case where the petitioner tried to argue that attorney's fees are actually compensatory, and the Supreme Court said no, these are punitive. So regardless of what the board's characterization of that remedy is, these remedies are punitive, whether you look at them in each one separately, if you look at them in whole, and that's what the dissent said. I mean, we have other remedies. The board didn't just stop there. They piled it on in this case, and it ordered remedies that really are extraordinary. And one thing every court has said is the board cannot be punitive. And at the end of the day, when you look at the remedies in this case, they are punitive. I mean, the payment of attorney's fees to the NLRB, no other agency has ever awarded itself attorney's fees, and there's a good reason why, because it's punitive.
So, Counsel, could I engage you on the shaming issue?
Yes.
As it comes out of the ALJ, we have an order that Nicola, Hayashi, or Watanabe read out this confession. And you object. And then for the board, that is modified so that it's got to be either one of those or a board representative in the presence of one of those. Now, and again, Bill Tenney, you didn't ask for reconsideration by the board, but put aside that. Are there any authorities that speak strongly against a remedy of a board official reading it, but a representative of the company should be on hand?
There are, and I, my time is up, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to find them. But I know this court's approach has been that it is acceptable to have a company representative read it, an undesignated company representative. But I know there is authority, and I believe it is cited in our brief, that either singling out a particular representative in the circuit is unacceptable. And if you have the board agent read it, what it does is it gives the imprimatur that the board is no longer neutral, but is on the side of the charging party. And I know there are cases, and I believe they're cited in our brief, that say that is over the line, because you're essentially taking the board and you're removing them from being neutral to being a partisan. And we did accept to that remedy. We there's a discussion about the reading it, and that was clearly an exception we filed, and we did discuss that in our brief. I think the board.
I see. So you, well, no, but I don't think I could have accepted to the remedy of having a board representative read it with the company official merely a witness, because I thought the ALJ only, required that the reader being one of these three company officials.
Right. We did accept to that, and we did discuss that. And again, I think when we accept to a notice reading remedy like that, and we say this case does not warrant any extraordinary remedies, the board is on notice that we are not going to agree to these type of remedies. And they clearly were on notice in this case. And I think these courts, the court's decisions, the Local 780 case, even in the Alwyn case, which we don't agree on the result, but the discussion there of 10E, I think, is very helpful and very instructive. 10E has been interpreted somewhat pragmatically to give courts an opportunity to weigh in on these very important issues.
So. Can I ask you a question, Mr. Rand,
yes,
about a very minor point, and that is in these bargaining costs, reimbursing the union for, among other things, reasonable salaries. That strikes me as... I know the board did the same thing in Fallbrook, but these union officials are going to be paid their salary, whether they're sitting at a negotiating table or not, and I don't know what reasonable expense salaries are either. Do you have any comment on that specifically?
It is punitive, okay? There is no, if we start with the basic proposition that the board's remedies must be compensatory and remedial and not punitive, you are absolutely correct. The union did not lose a penny here. Okay, there's a lot of speculation, but the bottom line is that the union business agents, they're paid a salary. You're right, whether they're sitting at a table with us, whether they're out organizing.
Well, I mean, is there anything in the record that they're paid more when they're negotiating, or that someone had to sit in their office while they were at the negotiating table and had to be, I mean, there was some double payment or something?
No, and the simple reason is that this was never asked for by anyone. So we never had a chance to develop that record.
Okay. That's the kind of thing you could have raised in your motion for reconsideration, couldn't you?
I'm
quite serious about this.
No.
I didn't see anything in the record about that. And the board's position was this was a total waste of time of everybody when your clients refused to go along with the agreement they agreed to and the ALJ approved.
Right.
I mean, it's a colossal waste of everybody's time. But your point is that for reasons that Judge Henderson's questions were inquiring about, it's punitive, and the board lacked authority. But you never made that point in moving for reconsideration or exceptions.
Right, you're right.
Or moving for reconsideration.
You're absolutely right, and I think under the unique facts of this case, that would constitute extraordinary circumstances, because 10E does have an exception. 10E is not just you do it or else.
I know, but the whole point is to let the board look at this. And you might well have gotten 3 votes to say, you know, these people are being paid. They don't, you know, double pay, that is a penalty. But the board never had a chance to respond to that.
Well, you're right.
And we're sitting here and we don't know the facts that are necessary to make any evaluation of this. Maybe the union's gone into bankruptcy as a result of this waste of time with your client. I mean, we don't just have any of that information.
Who's the burden on there, though? Burden's on the board.
The burden should be on the board.
Right.
And the reason you don't...
But what is the nature of the burden if no one raises any objection?
I think the board should be required to articulate and show to this court why these remedies are necessary and why they're compensatory. And they didn't do that.
What do they have to do? Do they have to bring the union in and say, well, you spend 140 days on this case. If you hadn't had to spend 140 days, then you would have been able to spend more time negotiating in another context. I mean, is that what we're talking about? And if so, why doesn't the board get a chance to address that?
Well, the board chose not to address it, okay? The board could have, when it got to them, it could have remanded this case for development of that factual record. Because one thing the board did that I haven't mentioned is there's 3 things the board can do. You can reconsider, you can reopen, or you can have a rehearing. The board did something kind of interesting here. They reopened the record just for them to note that we actually did have a collective bargaining agreement. Now, they didn't give notice to anybody. They didn't allow us to develop the record. But I think the board here has the burden to come in and say there's actually a harm, there's an injury that we're going to remedy, that these are compensatory. And they didn't do that. And
well,
again,
their view is different, and I understand that. Their view is they're trying to put people back where they would have been had your client's conduct not, in the board's unanimous view, gone to the very core of the board's operation and just put one obstacle in its way after another. That's the board's view. Now, maybe they're wrong about that in terms of, theoretically, they may be right, but the effect is punitive. But they never had a chance to address that.
You're right, but...
And we don't know what they might have said.
You're right, and all it is speculation based upon the position of the 3 board members. But the problem with a remedy like that is bargaining can be a very long process because of both sides. Okay, both sides, you know, you have mandatory subjects, you're allowed to insist to impasse upon them, and it's very easy to blame the employer because, you know, the employer took different positions. But there's no discussion of the union's behavior and whether any of its positions were very difficult, and they insisted to impasse on things that were unacceptable to the employer.
Well, was that brought to the board's attention?
No, because they never asked. They didn't.
Well, motion for reconsideration. Yeah. Make it clear, you know? I mean, that's all I'm getting at.
Right. Judge, I can't stand in front of you and say I filed one, right? But I think our exceptions to the board, coupled with this court's pragmatic approach and the extraordinary circumstances exception, give this court jurisdiction over all of our issues, and we would ask that they reverse.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll give you some time in response. Ms. Sheehy.
Yeah. Good morning, Your Honors. Barbara Sheehy for the National Labor Relations Board. I'll start first with, there are a number of issues in play, but I think there's the one that the board briefs that would dispose of everything, which is the position that all of the sua sponte remedies were waived by HTH by its failure to file a motion for reconsideration after the board acted.
Well, counsel's point is, you know, piling on, these are not normal remedies. This is just punitive. And that's an extraordinary situation. And you know, Tenney allows for that.
I don't know that the number of remedies imposed is actually all that extraordinary, given that it tracks the weight of the evidence, that you had an extraordinary number of violations that needed to be remedied. So I don't think we can look strictly to the number of what happened here and say, well, that must be extraordinary. And I think what the big problem, I think, and it's been touched on a number of different questions and answers here, is that the board, certain of the remedies, certainly, there was a very thorough discussion among the five board members. Although I would note that this court has said the discussion itself is not sufficient to accord jurisdiction. That notwithstanding, certainly there was a lot of discussion, as I said, on the attorney's fee issue, predominantly the attorney's fee issue, and then also, to a lesser extent, the negotiating expenses, but not to the extent that they were objected to. So let's be very clear who dissented and on what grounds. The only real dissent we have, where there is all of these issues out there, is the attorney's fees. Beyond that, we don't have a dissent from Johnson or members Johnson or Ms. Gamara on whether or not negotiating expenses were appropriate. There's the issue of the non-bargaining costs that two of the members objected to, but the negotiating expenses themselves. So to your point, Judge Henderson, that's an excellent question on what exactly a reasonable salary, what does that mean in terms of how do you implement that remedy? And that, frankly, was on the part of that, the burden is on HTH once that order is imposed to seek clarification from the board. What do you mean by reasonable attorney's fees? We can show that these business agents are getting doubly paid. That's a wonderful basis for a motion for reconsideration and drawing that information to the board's attention. Failure to do that.
Camelot had been decided at the time of this, right?
Camelot had been decided, and on top of that, you also had
Doesn't that suggest possible futility for HTH?
Futility for all of its claims, or?
Well, certainly for the measure relating to bargaining and litigation costs.
Respectfully, no, I don't think it shows that it's futile. Let's do the bargaining costs first, because I think that's an easier issue. I think that this employer did have an obligation. If they wanted to object to say that we didn't understand that our conduct infected the core of bargaining, you don't have a dissent from members Johnson or Ms. Gamara or any of the other three. You have a 5-0 decision in that respect.
That suggests even more futility.
Or it's suggesting that they didn't offer any argument for anybody to consider, that the board was left with the evidence as it was and said, this conduct is no different than what you did in the 2010 series of cases that culminated also in negotiating expenses. So while the burden is certainly on the board.
I don't think you're hearing me. I'm suggesting that on the record as it was presented, given the context of the board's decisions, it was futile.
And I just don't think
you
that
you seem to be underscoring that.
Well, no, I think that it's
it was futile. There are loads of reasons they would have lost.
No, and I don't mean to do that. I just mean to say I think it's a dangerous idea to say that an employer is excused from challenging a remedy that's imposed against it because it's a really bad employer and the board really found a lot of violations against it.
You formulated it that way, but another way is to say that there was a very recent board precedent dead against it.
Camelot wasn't new. Camelot wasn't new law. Frontiers existed on bargaining.
I think I said recent. It was recent, right?
Certainly, it was recent, so absolutely.
It's not as if there's any indication the board was likely to change its mind between Camelot and HTH.
It's not that it needed to change its mind. It's that they applied the precedent. They applied what the law is for the behavior.
That's right. That suggests that a petition for reconsideration would have been futile. You don't respond to that proposition.
And
you just keep saying HTH was really bad.
I don't think it would have been futile necessarily. I think that 10E, I don't know that an adverse case with a similarly egregious employer that preceded you by 2 or 3 years, I don't know that that's sufficient to say, I don't have to tell the board anything about anything I objected to in its decision because it would have been futile. Because here's part of the problem with that. Futility. For what reason is it futile? For what reason is the board's decision infirm? And part of the problem we have here, for instance, and I'll shift gears a little bit to the attorney's fee. You heard opposing counsel stand up and talk a lot about the punitive nature, and that's why the argument that the attorney's fees are inappropriate because they're punitive. They not only don't raise that in a motion for reconsideration, we all know, they don't even have that in their brief to this court. That's in Camelot's brief. So it's a very moving target, and I think that that's just indicative of what this litigation has been. It's just been anytime the board in this case imposed a remedy, they objected and they said, we just object to anything that you do, and that should be sufficient because we would have been futile. And I don't know that under 10E law that futility under those circumstances justifies the extraordinary circumstances. In fact, this court in Alwyn said that extraordinary circumstances were not present when somebody failed to object to the imposition of attorney's fees. This court has also said in subsequent cases that the discussion among board members is not sufficient. The only case that I'm aware of that speaks to the futility of a 10E argument, and we talk about this in the brief, is the Fifth Circuit case. But I think that was it wasn't just a pure issue of futility that granted the court there invoked its jurisdiction. It also considered the fact that in that case, the board wasn't even trying to invoke 10E. The board was not seeking to prevent the argument from being made. It was the intervener. And the Fifth Circuit in that case spoke both to futility and the use of 10E as a sword for an intervener, and that wasn't its purpose. So I don't know that this court's jurisprudence supports an argument of futility. And I wanted to, let's see, I wanted to also speak to the argument that this is, and I think I've sort of touched on this, but I just want to be clear on it, that this is not the only case of litigation expenses. So to the extent there's also the argument that they weren't on notice or they didn't have an opportunity to be heard, setting aside the issue if they had every opportunity, if they had just availed themselves of the board practices and filed a motion for reconsideration, they were also on notice of the board's standards for imposing various remedies. Indeed, this employer is perhaps on better notice than others because it's had extraordinary remedies imposed against it. But specific to the attorney's fees, on page 3 of the decision and order, and I'm sorry, I don't have my appendix, I just have the DNO, but there's a listing of cases that the board relies on for litigation, and that's not even an exhaustive list. So it's simply inaccurate to say that this is one of the first times that the board, outside of unbelievable, that the board has imposed litigation expenses. It's simply not true.
What about the argument that to the extent the board is relying on the bad faith exception to the American rule, that in light of the Supreme Court's decision, attorney's fees imposed under that exception are punitive?
What's the board's position on that? So I'll answer that. And before I do, I just want to note that that's not something that they argue. That's not even in it wasn't before the court. It's not even in their brief.
I know. I thought it was an interesting point at oral argument.
But that notwithstanding, I'm obviously not going to dodge based on that. But we put this in the second case, in the Camelot brief.
Right.
We speak to the issue of, yes, the Supreme Court, when it spoke about the bad faith exception in Hall, said it's punitive. But then I think what you see later, so first, that's not in the context of somebody examining whether or not an action is punitive for purposes of stepping outside the bounds of the board's authority, which I think is a relevant distinction. The court can use a term to say something is punitive without necessarily saying, in the context of what we're saying here, is it punitive to the extent that it exceeds the board's authority and it is stepping over remedial and deterrent grounds. So there's that first. And then
you raise an interesting question. What do you see as the function of the Chambers case repetition several times of the proposition that awarded fees on a basis of bad faith was punitive.
I think actually Chambers helps us. I think it helps the board's position here that it's not punitive, because in Chambers, what they find, because there's the offender in that case trying to get out from underneath liability for the damages, saying relying on state law to say that these damages for shifting of the fees is punitive, and under state law you can't impose punitive damages. So the Supreme Court in that case said, not so fast. Even under state law,
state law has nothing to do with it, right?
But they found that it was not punitive, because the Chambers Court does say that. Chambers Court speaks to, and we cite this in our brief, it's page 2138. That's what the Westlaw site. Sorry, page 54. The Chambers Court speaks to the substantive state policy is not implicated here, where the sanctions imposed were for the conduct during the litigation. Here, the district court did not attempt to sanction the petitioner for breach of conduct, but rather imposed sanctions for the fraud he perpetrated on the court and the bad faith he displayed toward both his adversary and the court throughout the litigation. So our reading of that is that's on page 54 and 55 of Chambers. Oh, I can cite to you in our brief, too, if that would help you.
Yeah, that would hit. Yeah. You said you were citing the brief.
Sorry, I thought you wanted Chambers. you know what? It's going to be in the Camelot brief, I believe. Because, again, they didn't argue punitive in this case. We naturally didn't address it. But Chambers is in the subsequent brief. Let's see. It starts on page 32 of the board's brief in the subsequent case in Camelot. So our view of that is that Chambers actually speaks to, it's not punitive, the damages aren't punitive if they're not going to the underlying conduct, which I think begs the question, right? Like, here is the board's remedy going to the underlying conduct. And I think the best thing to do is to look at what was the conduct that was found to be sufficient to warrant fees in Chambers. Because that, our view of the Supreme Court's decision there was that it was not punitive. And in that case, if you look at the conduct, it's remarkably similar to the conduct here. So it didn't go to the underlying breach of contract claim. It went to what was the offender's conduct before the tribunal in that case. And if that conduct was in bad faith, then fees are okay in that instance because they weren't punitive. So they weren't precluded by the state statute in that case. And there, specifically, the conduct was there was a false and frivolous pleadings. There was fraud. There was attempt by other tactics of delay, oppression, harassment, and massive expense to reduce NASCO to exhausted compliance. So we would argue that the conduct here and that the reason that the board imposed the fees was for the conduct in litigation, which, again, our view, and page 32, 33 of the brief, is that the Supreme Court has found that that, by its nature, is not necessarily punitive. And then I only have one other thing, unless the court has any other questions on the other.
Oh, could you speak to the shaming remedy?
That's where I was going to go.
Very firm in your brief that we can't consider, at least as I understood it, anything that happened after the ALJ, to which there was to whose order there was a proper objection. So to the extent that the board, in my view, softened the order, we should disregard that.
I'm sorry, ask that question again. I'm sorry. We don't object. Maybe it's not clear in the brief. There are two parts of the remedy that the board does not try to invoke a 10E jurisdiction. It may not be clear in the brief, and that's because we recognize that they did in part preserve part of that. So we don't have a 10E claim on the public reading.
Public reading by the company officials.
By the company officials, right. We have a claim that the board, our response to their claim is not that it's jurisdictionally barred, but that it's completely adverse to this court's precedent on when it's appropriate to do a public reading.
But you don't argue, do you, that the objection to the company officials' reading claim is moot? Right? Because the board's order frames it in the alternative with the, to me at least, less questionable order.
Right. I think the board's trying to cure.
Being an option of the company to have somebody there while a board official reads it.
Right. And I don't think the board did anything unique here. I think they took the administrative law judge's decision, realized that by designating an official who will read that notice, that that's not proper under the law. So they made a minor tweak to that and said, put in the or language, or a board official, which brings it squarely within the confines of this court's law, saying that that's proper.
So you are invoking that defense of?
Not a 10E defense, no. I'm sorry, I know there's so many defenses.
That defense of the outcome.
Yes, we are defending the outcome of the board's modification.
On the basis that it ameliorated the order.
Absolutely. Sorry for any confusion on that, yes. And that was actually the last point that I was going to try to get to.
Okay.
So unless the court has any other questions on the other remedies or the other issues. Thank you. And obviously for seeking full enforcement of the board's order.
Why don't you take a couple minutes, Mr. Rand?
Thank you very much. Let me address the chambers issue, because I have chambers, and I would point to the court 501 U.S. at 53, where the court says, as chambers recognize, the case of the bad faith exception to the American rule, the underlying rationale of fee shifting is, of course, punitive. And there's also a footnote where they rejected their attempt to try to label it as compensatory. Fee shifting under the bad faith exception, which is what the board did here, is clearly punitive, and that is beyond the board's statutory authority. We did argue that the board's remedies must be remedial in nature and cannot exceed that, and of course the board went well beyond that here, and it is also ultra vires because the board simply does not have that inherent authority. What's interesting is the board in its brief does not cite a decision from another agency. Not a single other agency has imposed the kind of fees that the board has. It's one thing to sanction litigants in front of you, and we understand that, but it's another thing. In fact, the board has a rule. They have an administrative rule that talks about misconduct of attorneys in front of it and how they deal with that. They didn't invoke that in this case. Instead, they're saying it's inherent authority. One other last point, Your Honors, is nowhere in the board's brief do they show you cases where the board has invoked the extraordinary circumstances exception on motions for reconsideration and actually reconsidered a decision where all five members of the board have weighed in and have changed their mind. So we think in this case it absolutely would have been futile. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.